This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV program on Free Speech TV and on our website. A 28-year-old white man from Baltimore, who police say traveled to New York with the intent of killing black men, has been charged with 2 counts of murder as an act of terrorism. According to news reports, James H. Jackson told police he had a, quote, long-standing visceral hatred of black people, which prompted him to board a bus and head to New York City. Jackson spent 3 days in the city looking for victims after finally confronting a 66-year-old black man named Timothy Kaufman. Jackson has admitted to fatally stabbing Kaufman with a sword. At the same time as this story broke, reports swirled in social media about 14 black girls going missing in Washington, D.C. on a single day. While the report was since debunked, a town hall meeting to address the ongoing epidemic of missing black and brown children drew hundreds of people. The story has revived a conversation about the discrimination that black Americans in particular face in terms of resources and attention when their children go missing compared to white children. My guest is Melina Abdullah. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University of Los Angeles, and she's active with the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. Welcome to the program, Melina.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Well, to me, these two stories that came so soon within days of one another really illustrate the reason for us to keep reminding ourselves that Black Lives Matter. So let's talk about what happened in New York first. This white supremacist who is just openly admitting what he did, does this to you seem to be the kind of thing we are seeing more of in an age of Donald Trump, when white supremacy seems to have become more overt, coming out of the shadows and actually taking lives once more?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this age of Trump, this moment that we're in, has absolutely torn the mask off of white supremacy. So there was a period where it was not acceptable to be as blatant in the white supremacist kind of actions and rhetoric as it is now. But Trump, as the person who currently occupies the White House, really kind of demonstrates to the public that it's now okay to be a full-blown sheet-wearing white supremacist again. So many folks have said, you know, red caps have replaced white sheets. I think that red caps are going on top of white sheets, and we can see it with what happened to Brother Kaufman up in New York. And we have to remember that that was a hate crime, that was a white supremacist killing, that was terrorism. And we also see it with pro-Trump demonstrations that have been happening around the country. So we had one right here, and I think it was Huntington Beach, where they had a pro-Trump demonstration just about a week ago, and you saw some similar things happen. No one died, but you did see attacks on people of color who showed up for counter demonstrations. And so I think that Trump is kind of leading the way. Trump and his entire, we'll call it a legion of doom, are leading the way and saying, you know, it's okay to be kind of a full-blown, overt white supremacist again in this country. And that's a very, could be a very frightening thing, but I think it also demands that we not only kind of see it for what it is, but that we stand up and rise up against it.
When Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked about the murder and asked to condemn it during his daily press briefing, this happened just hours before the terrorism charge was actually applied, he basically, you know, hemmed and hawed and avoided really addressing the matter head on. He said Trump wanted to unite the country. Yes, hate crimes and anti-Semitic crimes of any nature should be called out. And then he basically blamed the media, which is a standard standard tactic for jumping on people on the right regarding bomb threats against Jewish community centers. I mean, all it takes is for Sean Spicer and or Trump to simply say, it's unconscionable what this man did and that should never happen. They have trouble just saying that, Melina.
Right, and I think it's because, again, there's this devaluing of Black life. There's this devaluing of people of color more broadly. And I think that they, ever since the election, ever since Trump initially announced his run, his whole MO has been to whip up a frenzy among white supremacists. And he does not, that's his base. That's part of his base, at least. And so he doesn't want to alienate them. And I think that Spicer is following suit, of course, as the mouthpiece for the Trump administration. And so they're not going to condemn oppression or violence or killings against Black people. And in fact, you've seen it play out not only among kind of these vigilante killings, but here in Los Angeles, we've seen a 30% increase in officer-involved shootings. Police are kind of saying that they have carte blanche to do whatever they want in communities. And that comes from what the Trump administration's rhetoric has been and what their policies have been just in this last, 65, 66 days.
Well, just staying on the story of this white supremacist who has admitted to killing Timothy Kaufman, he spent 3 days in New York City stalking people, looking for potential victims. And his main goal was apparently to stop interracial couples, you know, Black and white, Black men and white women from being with one another. This harkens back to that historic fear, right, of Black male sexuality. It is reminiscent of the justifications that were made for lynchings over the history of this country. He basically also said he sort of didn't know that Timothy Kaufman was elderly. He would have rather killed a, quote, young thug or a, quote, successful older Black man with blonde women. First of all, how does this reflect the ugly history of Jim Crow racism in the United States? But also, Melina, how does it reflect media narratives and also politicians' narratives, white conservative politicians' narratives about Black Americans and the kind of pejoratives that are used?
So I think there's so much in there, right? So we can, you know, really try to delve deeply into all of those. We can analyze all of those points. I think that one of the things that we see, of course, it conjures images of Birth of a Nation in that film and this notion of kind of ravenous Black men who were going after white women. And we know that those were simply fears that were implanted in the minds of white society to justify the oppression and brutalization of Black people. We also know that when we think about the first lynching era, because we can, I think at this point, call this a second lynching era. When we think about the first lynching era, Ida B. Wells was very methodical and very thorough in her analysis when she pointed out that in her journalistic reports that although it's commonplace to assume that the allegations were ones of assault against white women, most of those who were lynched were actually lynched because they posed an economic threat to white society. So when we think about what spurred the organizing work of Ida B. Wells, it was the murder of her friends who ran a grocery store that competed with the white grocers, right? And so even if you think about that quote from the killer that he'd rather have killed a successful, quote unquote, successful Black man, right? This is, again, this notion of economic threat. And so even though there's, they know that on a visceral level, white society is much more fearful of a quote unquote Black thug, a ravenous Black man who's going after white women, right? The real fear is that white capitalism is being challenged. And so they understand, I think that there's another point to be made about the media's role, mainstream media's role in kind of drowning out the resistance movement, although those who are in power know that resistance is there, the Black resistance movement in particular. And so the real, I think, impetus for these kinds of crimes, but also the casting of Black people as criminals, is the fear of an uprising from the most oppressed people in society. And so this is a way to both entrench fear among white folks that Black people have to kind of be contained and controlled, but also among Black folks that if you rise up, this is what will happen to you. And it's said in a very subtle way, but if you think about how it's taken hold in Black communities, it's meant we'd better embrace this notion of respectability so that we can ensure our own safety. And we know that respectability never ensures our safety, but that's the rhetoric that's out there.
Melina, are you heartened that this person who admitted to killing Timothy Kaufman has been charged with murder as an act of terrorism? This is New York prosecutors who applied this charge. We remember the case of Dylann Roof, charged with murdering, you know, so many Black people in a church in South Carolina, was not charged by the federal Justice Department with terrorism. A lot of people were upset about that because somehow it seems as though in order to be charged with terrorism, you have to be brown-skinned and or Muslim. In this case, are you heartened that they're at least charging him with terrorism?
Well, I'm glad to hear that he's charged with terrorism, for sure. I think that there'll be a lot more work to do to have a fuller and more truthful view of what terrorism is. We know that white folks are almost never charged with terrorism, yet most of the mass murders in this country are carried out by white folks. And that's something hopefully this case can be used to kind of shift that misrepresentation of what terrorism is.
Let's turn to the other story about, in the DC area. This is a story that began when a tweet went viral claiming that 14 Black girls had gone missing in one day in Washington, D.C. And it turned out that the allegation was false. However, when examined more closely, we find that even though there has been a slight lowering of a slightly smaller number of children, Black and brown children, in general children going missing in the D.C. area this year compared to previous years, 37% of children that go missing in the U.S. each year are African American. That is incredible. Melina, how important is it for this conversation, even if it was prompted by what turned out to be a debunked issue, that it's important that we have this conversation?
Right. So what was, I think, even more disturbing about this story, and when the story came out, when it went viral, I think I, along with every other Black mother, became immediately fearful, right? Yeah. So I don't scare easily, but when you talk about, you know, children and attacks on children, it makes me hold my children close. So I remember being in Target just days after the story broke and telling my 10-year-old, you must not get out my sight. No, you cannot go look at the toys, right? Mm. It really, I mean, scared so many of us. But I think what's disturbing, so when it came out that there's no increase in the number of missing girls in D.C., that, you know, it was just that it was reported differently, I think it bothered me when I watched the officer, the D.C. officer, who said it as if she herself, being a Black woman, said, you know, there's been no increase in missing children in D.C., and said it as if, you know, there's nothing to worry about. And I think it's really disturbing that when something happens to our children, we're told that there's nothing to worry about, that it's normal for this number, and they actually used that word, that it's normal for this number to be missing, right? And we can think about everything from, you know, the Grim Sleeper case in Los Angeles, where very few people even talked about the Grim Sleeper case, where over 100 Black women were disappeared and killed, to, you know, the number of children who were in the foster care system, and the percentage of which, you know, the high percentage that are Black and then are, you know, often opened up for trafficking and for human trafficking and for incarceration. And so I think that, again, this goes to the question, and I really appreciate your framing, of Black lives mattering, right? So when Black children are missing, when Black children are trafficked, when Black children are criminalized, it is not seen as an emergency. It's seen as normal. And I think that this is why we have to continue to do the work, because it's not okay for our children to be missing. I don't care if there's not an uptick this year over last year. You know, it's unacceptable for children to be trafficked and missing and even running away. That's unacceptable. Yeah. And we need to think about what prompts them to run away and how do we keep our children safe.
Right. And on this issue of runaways, the organization Black and Missing Foundation, the co-founder of the organization told press, "We noticed that a lot of African-American children that go missing are initially classified as runaways. They do not get an Amber Alert or media coverage." So how does that feed into the notions? I mean, we've seen study after study, for example, show that police, teachers, just bystanders, overestimate the age of Black children. Black children aren't seen as innocent compared to white children. And it seems to be consistent with this idea that when Black children go missing, they might be assumed to be runaways. They left of their own volition, as opposed to something horrific happening to them and them being snatched. Or even as runaways, them maybe running away from a situation where they are the victim rather than simply choosing to walk away from a life.
Right. And even so, absolutely to all of that, right? So Black children are overestimated. They're also thought to be criminals more often, mm-hmm. right? So at very, very early ages, Black children are criminalized. And I can give just a few examples from my daughter's own elementary school where, you know, I'll give her example where she brought vitamin C to school to give out to her friends. This was 2 years ago when she was 7 years old, brought vitamin C to school. And the school immediately calls me and said, the police are on their way. And by the time I got there, they had called LAPD on a second grade child for bringing vitamin C to school. And they were trying to charge her with bringing drugs to school. Now, this is a seven-year-old who thinks, you know, whose mother gives her orange-flavored vitamin C every day to fight off colds and thinks she's doing a good thing by bringing vitamin C to share with her her friends. But schools are criminalizing our children as young as seven. In LAUSD, we know that there is a required random stop and frisk of our children. So every high school in the entire district is required to do random searches on school children, pulling them out of their classrooms and searching them for contraband. Now, we would think, you know, that contraband is things like weapons and drugs. What are they really searching for? They're searching for whiteout, hand sanitizer, and highlighters, which is contraband in LAUSD. Now, when we talk about the racial issue on this, we know that the more affluent schools are not pulling children out of their math classes, right? The more affluent schools are kind of signing on the dotted line and not actually doing these random searches. But in schools like Dorsey High School and Crenshaw High School, they are pulling the children sometimes out of their tests to search their backpacks and search their persons for items that are not criminal to carry, but the school has decided is contraband. So I'm saying all of that to say that the missing children, the idea that Black children are runaways and kind of criminalized for that behavior, is part of an overall kind of process of criminalizing Black people almost from birth. Mm-hmm. And then that, of course, feeds not only the system of mass criminalization, but the system of mass incarceration. And so I think that we absolutely, this is an opportunity for us to shift that narrative and say that when Black children are runaways or are abducted or are trafficked, we need to treat them as children, not as criminals. And we have to give the attention, our full attention, to getting them back home, getting them safe, addressing whatever things, if they are runaways, whatever motivated them to run away in the first place.
Finally, Melina, I want to end with this idea that missing Black children, Black people being attacked by white supremacists, should not just be a Black problem. This is an American problem. Trayon White, who is a city council member in DC, organized a town hall meeting about the missing children earlier this week, and hundreds of people attended. But photographs of the attendees showed that they were almost uniformly, I mean, there was not a white face to be seen in the audience, as though the only people who cared about missing Black children were Black people. How important is it for us to emphasize that the whole idea of Black Lives Matter is a message to America, right? I mean, this is a message to non-Black Americans.
Right. And when we think about a city that's gentrifying as rapidly as DC, for those folks who are moving into what used to be Chocolate City when I mm-hmm. lived there, to not care about the residents who were there before they arrived, to not care about the children of the residents who were there before they arrived, is hugely problematic. For them to give more attention to their dogs and, you know, their rights to have dogs out in public and in grocery stores and, you know, restaurants, rather than caring about people, right, is a huge issue. And I'm not saying don't care about dogs, but I'm saying that when we talk about human children, there seems to be a disconnect among many white folks, especially white folks. I think that we have an alternative model that's building. When we think about White People for Black Lives and the tremendous work that organizations like Surge, Aware, and other orgs are doing, I think there's an opportunity for white folks to also shift, right? So just here in Los Angeles on Sunday, White People for Black Lives organized and went out to Ciclovia and did some phenomenal work to try and raise consciousness that Black lives mattering means that everybody recognizes that Black lives matter. And when Black lives actually matter, when we are no longer at the bottom of every economic, social, and political measure, that actually raises the humanity of the entire country and all of society, right? So when the folks at the very bottom are lifted, all of us are lifted. And so we need everyone to commit themselves. The final thing that I just want to add is that there's been a complete media whiteout of the work that Black Lives Matter has been doing. So you haven't seen us on media. That means other than your show, right, and other independent media sources. But mainstream media has chosen to white us out. That doesn't mean that the work has stopped. In fact, the work has actually been ratcheted up. And so we need people to seek us out, to figure out what it is we're doing. Black Lives Matter will be in D.C., on Saturday, April 1st, and all around the country and world, we're calling for a day of what we're calling sacred resistance, where we're summoning everything we have in our power, meditative power, prayer power, chanting, dance, whatever it is you do, we need you to do it to topple white supremacy and lift up justice and peace. And so we're continuing to do the work. We're encouraging all of your viewers and listeners to follow Black Lives Matter and not rely on kind of the mediation of mainstream media to tell you whether or not we're active. We're here, we're gonna remain here, and we need everyone to join us.
Where's a good place for people to find out about these events? Can they follow on Twitter? If so, which Twitter account? Can you give out some information?
Sure. So Twitter is BLMLA for Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, or for the Sacred Resistance event, it's Sacred Resist. There's also a website, sacredresist.org, and Black Lives Matter is on, has a website, blacklivesmatter.com.
That's sacredresist.org and blacklivesmatter.com. We will post all of those details on our website later today so that you can find them there. Melina, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest is Melina Abdullah, professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State Los Angeles. She's active with the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.